Welcome to The Point. I'm Mindy Todd. Our mission at WCAI is this: to enrich people's lives through programs and services that educate, inspire, and entertain, fostering citizenship and culture, the joy of learning, and the power of diverse perspectives. The fact is, like many American newsrooms, our staff is mostly white. Of 9 journalists, we have 1 journalist of color on staff. We've made efforts to bring diversity training to the newsroom, to hire and retain people of color, and to actively search out the stories of marginalized members of our community. We recognize that we need to do more. As a majority white newsroom, the WCAI news staff is learning to recognize our privileged position in society and acknowledge that we don't experience the world in the same way Indigenous and other people of color in our community do. These facts will continue to guide us as we make decisions about the news we cover and the stories we tell. We've made mistakes along the way, and we'll likely make more in the future. Our goal is to be open to criticism, learn, and do better in the future. We want WCAI, both in the newsroom and on the airwaves, to be a place where we listen to one another and learn from one another, even if what we hear makes us uncomfortable. In the coming weeks and months on The Point, we plan to tackle some difficult topics around racism and white privilege. Next Thursday, June 25th, our focus will be what white people can do to educate themselves about racial injustice and white privilege, how to become allies for people of color. Today, our focus is the Black Lives Matter protests. Throughout our country, in fact, around the globe, people of all colors, ages, and nationalities are standing together to say no more. Are the protests the start of meaningful and fundamental change, or have we been down this road before, a road that aims to bring about change but instead roots us back to the status quo? In a few minutes, we'll talk with an historian and activist, but first we hear the voices and stories of people of color living on the Cape and Islands. Racial injustice, institutionalized racism, and white privilege are part of our country's history and very much present in our society today. Even here on the Cape and Islands, people of color experience racism and live in a society and region created and developed by white people for white people.
My name is David Vandehoop. I'm an Akwinan Wampanoag who grew up on Nompi. First, I would like to start with an acknowledgement of the Wampanoag people, past and present, and our territory. I am in the understanding with many other Indigenous people that all other Americans live on unceded land, and that Nompi, or Martha's Vineyard, is Wampanoag territory, and the same is true everywhere on this continent. I grew up in a semi-traditional way. We lived off the land, and I have been gathering, hunting, fishing my entire life, and so did the rest of my generation. I have a deep connection to the land that is known by many Indigenous people as land being our identity. I started Sassafras Earth Education with my wife about 18 years ago to reconnect people to an original, regenerative lifestyle and to do that for our fellow Wampanoag children. Wampanoag people have been supporting the Black community here on the island since the times of slavery. As a matter of fact, the house I live in, my grandfather and grandmother's house, was part of the Underground Railroad that led enslaved people to freedom. It is important that people of color stand together during this time because we understand and share a very similar history of oppression, and we can see things that white people, at least up till now, don't. What I would like to say to non-Indigenous people in our community is this: I am an ancestor that is part of the 5% that remain. 95% of our people were destroyed. Nobody has ever apologized or made amends from the government. Instead, our native struggle continues every day over access to basic needs like clean water, the right to live, health care, work, and income. Our people face the worst statistics of all people in the United States. Up to today, we do not have the same rights as other U.S. citizens, as we are still under plenary power, meaning that the army can come in and do what they like at any time, still today. I regard you as guests, and mostly uninvited. There's a lot of room for improvement, consideration, and respect. Wampanoag children in the school systems are still being treated differently, and many people don't even see it. Many white people idolize being native and ask me just too many questions, and that is annoying. It's time that things change for our Black sisters and brothers, people of color, and for all Indigenous people of the world.
One of the local pioneers of civil rights was Eugenia Forts, who died in 2006 at the age of 94. She's been called the Rosa Parks of Cape Cod. We have a clip of Eugenia, courtesy of Tales of Cape Cod Oral History Collection, recalling segregation on the Cape.
In your early days in the Cape, was discrimination, other than the school segregation, a problem?
Yes, it was. But we were all so poor that we couldn't afford to go to the different places. In fact, I remember my father came here to help me with some work I had that he could do for me here at the house here. And I was taking him home, and he liked a beer now and then. And it was a hot day. And we stopped in Yama, and he went into this place where they sold beer. It wasn't really a bar room. I guess you'd call it that, but it was small. And he came out, and he was very perturbed because they made him sit in a back room. He couldn't be served in the front. I'm glad you spoke of that, because I'd like to let that out, because it upset him so.
Do you recall any other situations such as that?
Yes, I had two tickets once given to me. The Masonic group here in Hyannis used to have dinners on Saturday nights years ago in the 30s. And I had two tickets given to me. And this person didn't realize that they segregated, wouldn't take you. So she gave me these two tickets. And this friend of mine and I went to the dinner. And we got as far as the door. And this was Henry Finney of Hyannis, who was one of the big Masons in town. He and his son Homer were taking tickets at the door. And he told me no, they would have to refund me the money because I couldn't come in.
My name is Robin Joyce Miller. I'm an African-American resident of Marston's Mills. I attend West Parish of Barnstable, UCC. It is a predominantly white church. When they held sessions on white privilege, I knew that they would expect me to address this issue, especially since my husband and I speak about race on Cape Cod. Here is my poem explaining what it means not to have white privilege. Never had the privilege. Never had the privilege to sail to liberty. We traveled as ship cargo, no chance of being free. Never had the privilege to have just one fine man. My husband could just watch me scream, "Master takes me 'cause he can." Once we had the privilege, after slavery, during Reconstruction, to rise 'cause we were free. But then the southern breeze bore strange and swinging fruits, poplar trees bleeding from the leaves down to their roots. Never had the privilege to rise up and be free, paralyzed by the thought of claiming liberty. Never had the privilege to struggle on the land, to claim it as my very own, only sharecropped for the man. Never had the privilege to become Mrs. Gladys Height. My name was always, "Come here, girl, I'm calling you." That's right. Never had the privilege to eat at the Five and Dime, but I could wash the dishes and scrub the floors just fine. Never had the privilege, when traveling on a bus, to find a decent restroom, 'cause I ain't white enough. Never had the privilege to see someone like me, when I was just a child, be respected on TV. Then we had the privilege, as Obama, president, and a person they call Oprah, this must be evident, that race is not an issue, not even a concern. What's with this Black Lives Matter stuff? It's wrong and it's divisive. America is not racist. These rebels are misguided. Is it a law or a privilege that a person is presumed innocent until proven guilty? Well, never had the privilege to prove innocence or guilt. My black skin was the evidence for which my blood was spilt. Never had the privilege. Never had the privilege. Never had the privilege.
My name is Carl Lopes, and I live in Marston's Mills. I am a Cape Cod artist and a retired visual arts director of Barnstable High School in Hyannis. Being a Cape Cod person of color, Cape Verdean, and interacting both professionally and socially with thousands of youth and families, I found a majority of us citizens to be fair and open-minded regarding inclusiveness and equity. But there is a definite undercurrent of discrimination and non-inclusion that pervades us. Albeit subtle, it's here on Cape Cod. Racism has been a lifetime experience for me. There have been moments in my life where racism was not a concern, and then moments where it was all-consuming. As a 35-year career educator, I have witnessed many instances of racism among our youth, as well as the adult population. The following are a few examples. Students of color have many times entered my classroom upset because they had just been called the N-word on their way to class. My classroom was many times used as a safe room where a student could recompose after experiencing a racial incident. Once, in response to a lecture I was giving on African art, a white student raised his hand to ask, "Why do we have to learn about this jungle bunny stuff?" On the last day of school one year, a student told me that in the beginning, he didn't think he would learn anything from me because I was black. But he was really surprised how much he did learn. Nonetheless, it was a racially biased and backhanded compliment. When I first became a faculty member, a colleague noted to me that he was surprised they hired a colored guy. A white student once called me boy, and a black student called me an Uncle Tom. It was even challenging to educate students of color not to use the N-word against each other. Individually, these experiences may seem trivial, but they point to an unhealthy undercurrent of a racially biased and non-inclusionary culture. People of color have faced centuries of oppression and have rallied against the laws that support systemic and institutionalized racism. I truly hope the peaceful protests will continue to spark meaningful conversations across our country for lasting change. It is important for our society to recognize social change is necessary. My hope is that conversation will inspire true unity in our community as well as across our nation.
My name is Kristen Harper. I live in Marston's Mills, and I am the minister of the Unitarian Church of Barnstable. What I want white people in Cape Cod to understand is that racism here is a daily experience. It's not just about being pulled over by the police for an emission sticker that is not out to date, but he, quote, thought it was, or being followed either physically or by someone's eyes in stores, or being stepped in front of when you're waiting in line as if you don't exist, or the mistaken identity over and over, or being served after white people in restaurants when you've gotten there first, or not being asked if you need help in a store when you are waiting for someone to notice you. It's about being treated poorly in our healthcare facilities, being told you have diabetes when you don't and you've never been tested for it, or asked if you are aware that you can get AIDS through unprotected sex when you are trying to get pregnant, or being shoved around by an X-ray tech when your back is screaming in pain and you're begging them to stop. It's being treated as if you're interfering when you are visiting a member of the church you serve in a nursing home or in the hospital. It's trying to have a nice meal and never being looked in the eye by the waiter or waitress. Racism here is an everyday experience.
We thank all who shared their stories. We also thank those who responded to our request to participate in the program, but let us know they were too tired of telling white people about their experiences with racism. And we thank one person who took the time to explain why they felt our request to participate was insensitive and potentially traumatic for people of color. We'll talk about the recent protests after a short break. You're listening to The Point. We're discussing racism. If you would like to join our conversation, 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Or you can send us an email, thepoint@capeandislands.org. The protests against police brutality and racial injustice have struck a chord with many. But do these protests feel different than the previous civil rights protests? Is this the start of meaningful change, or have we been here before? Joining us is Dolores Deluz, a civil rights activist Davis, who's documented the history of African Americans living in the town of Barnstable. She's also a founding member of the Zion Union Heritage Museum and a founding member and past officer of the Cape Cod NAACP. Welcome, Dolores.
Good morning.
Good morning. You have been calling for racial justice for a very long time. You grew up in segregated Delaware in the 1940s and then moved to the Cape. Give us a sense of what your life was like in Delaware before coming to Cape Cod.
Well, it was totally segregated. Schools, churches, stores downtown, water fountains, everything, the whole thing. It was just, it was not a good place to grow up.
Yeah.
But I had wonderful parents and wonderful teachers. Although the schools were segregated, we all learned a lot. We didn't get away with much because the teachers went to church with our parents every Sunday, so they kept a close eye on what was going on with their students. So it was a closed growing up, but it was we looked after one another. And when I moved up to the Cape in 1957 with my husband, and it was culture shock because I had never lived in a white community at all. The only white people we ever came in close contact with was the insurance man that came to my house, to my mother's house, to get the 10-cent policy. But so all my neighbors here, when I moved here, were white people, and it was like I didn't know how to deal with that. Mm-hmm. I still had very angry feelings for white people. It took me a while to just let anyone into my circle. There weren't many black people around when we came here in 57. So I had to make changes. I'm not a person to just live by myself. So I soon became acquainted with my neighbors and joined the Highness Junior Woman's Club. I was the only black woman there until I bought in Hilda Rosario and joined the with Julia Bernstein, Juliette Bernstein, the League of Women Voters. We joined the NAACP. And with Judy Barnett and Mabel Canto and Jane Vonnegut and Margaret Mosley, Helen Schaefer and Eugenia Forts, we formed the Fair Housing Committee. And that came about because black people weren't, even Joe and I couldn't find a place to live. Mm. So we finally did because he was a veteran. And General Patton Drive was built mostly for veterans. So we were able, through Mr. Cross, to get a place there. We kind of had to cozy up to just get in.
Yeah.
But Dolores, so other people could not find housing.
Right.
They came to the NAACP. We didn't know. So, like I said, with these ladies, especially Judy Barnett, headed it all. She's was a wonderful organizer and a community worker.
Yeah, Dolores, I want to ask you at this moment, there's a lot of anger about continued racial injustice and police brutality, and there's fear that loved ones will be senselessly and needlessly killed without accountability. This is exhaustion from having to repeat the calls for equality and justice decade after decade, and there's hope that now is the start to something new. Are you feeling hopeful?
You know, I have mixed feelings about it because, like I said before, I've just been through this movie so many times, and nothing happens that's worthwhile. I mean, they did a lot of talking, we did a lot of marching and a few things, but nothing really permanent, really stuck. I mean, even the voting rights they're trying to take away, I mean, to go back, you know, you get to a point and then it goes backwards because somebody's not happy, mostly white people or the people in charge. So here we are now, and it just had to take this man's life to get people going again. Although I remember the man in California that was beaten so badly. I can't think of his name right now. Oh, it was all over the. Can't yeah. we all just get along? That guy.
Rodney King. Yeah.
Nothing happened with that. That was the worst thing I ever saw on television. The policeman beating him and beating him and wouldn't let him up, and then they all got off without anything, and that's what caused all the riots, and because nothing was done. Hopefully now, maybe something will be done. There's some executive orders now for police reform, and we need that so badly because that's been our problem in many cases, where the police would plant guns on people, plant drugs on people. It's been just a whole thing with the police, you know?
Right. Yeah.
And now hopefully the chokeholder is going to be gone and everybody has to wear the cameras, and they have a database now that tracks the police officers. Because they were sent from place to place, you know, just like the Catholic priest, you know. What good came of that? If he was bad, they'd send him to another church. Same way with the police. If they were bad, they sent him to another precinct. You still got the same person, the bad person. Same thing.
So I guess it's fair to say that you're optimistically hopeful.
Optimistically hopeful. And I'm also kind of, you know, they're focusing on black people, but I think it's time to start profiling white males, because they're the ones that have, all the school shootings have been white males. The big thing out in Las Vegas, 52 people killed, white males. It's just been all, so they're the ones that carry the guns. I mean, you don't see black people right up face to the policeman with military gear on, with strapped themselves like they're going to war right here in this country. So it's time to start looking at white people.
Dolores, I'm going to bring in another voice in the conversation. Grayson Kirk, a youth activist on Martha's Vineyard who organized the demonstration on June 1st at Five Corners in Vineyard Haven, of course, in the response to killing of George Floyd. Welcome, Grayson.
Hi.
Grayson, many people were outraged at the killing of George Floyd, but not everyone organized a protest. What went through your mind when you heard about the killing, and what specifically motivated you to plan this protest?
When I first heard the news about George Floyd, honestly, it wasn't shocking. Growing up, I didn't grow up in a very wealthy neighborhood, but I was white, and I was aware of my privilege. And during my youth, I was kind of sheltered from that side of it because I grew up in New Hampshire in a place where the only ethnic people I knew were my uncle and my mom's friend, Odilon. So it really, it was just, I think, the tipping point for me. As soon as the video aired, I watched it over and over again, and it just it was hard for me to understand how something like that could happen. Mm-hmm. And I was trying to grasp what African American people were feeling watching this, but I couldn't, because I can never relate to that because of the color of my skin. Throughout my youth, I was taught to use my voice to be a young activist. My first protest was a protest because they were pulling funding from my school, and my parents put together a K-5 protest, and they marched us down to the public square, and we protest kids going to middle school at a younger age. Since then, I've been to women's marches. I went to the March for Our Lives in Washington, D.C. I went to Climate Change March in Boston. But I think this by far is the most meaningful and the most important, because it's the problem we're struggling with now. there's obviously Grayson,
tell us more about the protest. Who showed up for it, and what was the message that the protest was trying to send?
Well, a lot of more people showed up than I thought. When I first got the idea, I honestly thought it was just going to be me and my sign. And I was okay with that as long as I had a platform to voice my opinion, because if anyone knows Martha's Vineyards, it's a very isolated community. And a lot of the time, word doesn't really get out as much from this community. But over 500 people showed up. It was very powerful. I think the thing that struck me the most is the diversity in the people that showed up. It was black, white, people who were in their 80s, I saw this little girl who must have been 4 with a sign that she scribbled on, you know. It was very, a lot of different kinds of people. And I think the most powerful part of it is when we kneeled for 8 minutes and 46 seconds and just feeling the heaviness and the weight of that.
What are your thoughts on how to keep the momentum going and next steps to keep people engaged?
Well, I think that a lot of people will go to these marches or will repost something and they'll be like, oh, we're done. But really, this problem has been around for hundreds of years, so it's not going to go away overnight. I think just inspiring people to keep the momentum and keep the passion, and also just keeping people aware. If you keep being in people's faces about it, if you keep planning protests, if you keep bringing petitions to legislation, like repetition, I think will actually hopefully give people a wake-up call, and just getting people who are willing to fight until there is equality, people like me.
Grayson, we appreciate your time and hope that you'll keep us updated in what you and your peers plan and organize in the weeks and months to come. Thanks for being with us this morning. Appreciate that.
Of course.
Giving us a call, John Reed, president of the Cape Cod NAACP. Good morning, John.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm good. John, what are your thoughts on you know, Dolores is talking about, she's sort of, I guess, hopefully optimistic, but we've been down this road before. What are your thoughts?
Well, I have a variety of thoughts. First and foremost, the social justice committees across the Cape are meeting to talk about local strategies as well as state-level strategies. And Dolores is right about been to the dance too many times and nothing has come out of it. I believe, honestly, that not only do people need to continue expressing their opinions, because we tell you from an NAACP point of view, your First Amendment rights are still your rights. That hasn't been taken away yet. As things go on, though, and activities are planned, we need to teach people social responsibility, not just we can have a march, we can do this, we can do that. That's fine. But what happens after the march? Mm-hmm. What do you do then? What is your progressive action plan to get some concrete things done in each community? Cape Cod and the islands are unique situations. It's not a city. They are individual towns with different governing bodies on them, mainly select people, and there are subcommittees in the towns that people can participate in. I'm encouraging people to come on out of the house and participate in government, because unless you get an ordinance signed or a piece of legislation signed, which is going on right now at the State House through the Hispanic and Black Legislative Caucus, as well as Governor Charlie Baker, that affects us directly. It's not the thing that Trump did. That's global, and he's dependent upon Congress for passing a law. Representative Tim Scott's proposals have some merit, but it doesn't go far enough. The others at the local and state level, that's how we live, that's where we live, and we need to make that change through them.
John, thanks for calling, and appreciate your time this morning. And waiting patiently on the line is Morgan James Peters, or Mwalim as he's more commonly known. He's a performer, writer, and associate professor of English and Black Studies at UMass Dartmouth. Welcome.
Oh, thank you. Good morning.
And now you're an indigenous person of color. You're well-versed in the history of racial injustice, institutionalized racism, and white privilege in our country. Do the protests and demonstrations happening today feel different from civil rights protests of the past?
Well, I guess I could put it, I could put it to you this way. And yes, also a member of the Mashpee Wampanoag tribe. But I'm 52 years old, which means I was born in 1968. I was born 2 months after Martin Luther King was assassinated. So therefore, riots were going on literally the week I was born, because riots ensued following that. People were angry. People yelled for change. Remember, 1968 is when you had the Kerner Commission, who released a report where they said, yes, there is a big problem in the United States, and the problem is white people and white privilege. And, of course, after the report was released and people gasped in shock, it was basically put to the side. But, again, going back, being born in 1968 meant that my early childhood was part of the, quote-unquote, good years, because 1968, oh, we need to have more black people. We need to have more black people visible. Black teachers were not an uncommon thing for me. I had a black principal in my elementary school. I grew up, and also I should point out, my early years, I was in New York City. I was in the Northeast Bronx in a community called Co-op City, which was, at the time, very, very ethnically diverse. My neighbors were of various, you know, they were European white, they were Judaic, Jewish, they were Asian. We had people of the African diaspora, we had people of the various Latino communities. This was, you know, a very mixed thing. So the orientation of early childhood was very different. There were black people on TV. WGBH introduces Say Brother in Boston because they realized, thanks to James Brown's concert, that black people will watch public act, you know, will watch public television. So there was a Band-Aid on the bullet wound effect. Rockefeller Foundation, Ford Foundation were pouring money into black organization, into black arts. You had black theater companies and black arts organizations and black community programs springing up all over the place. All of this happening between the years of, say, 65 and about 73. And 73 was all of a sudden when it's like, okay, enough. We need to level things off. And, you know, the problem is we're still, you know, black is beautiful and afros and dashikis become part of Madison Avenue advertising. They have normalized blackness. Television shows all feature, you know, all kinds of TV shows featuring black people in on different levels. You have the economic highs of the Jeffersons and the lows of Good Times. You know, this is... Mm-hmm. This is what you grew up with, and then you move transition from that to Cosby, et cetera. What happens is a very hard hit to that entire era, I should say. First 12 years of life are considered the good years. And then 1980, we elect a pro-apartheid noted racist as president. You know, Ronald Reagan comes into office. And then we begin to see the pushback. We see the pushback on a national level. We see the pushback on a local level. And this is when my peers and I, because one of the people who we were constantly taught about in school was Martin Luther King. Martin Luther King, be peaceful, be nonviolent. That's the way people should be. Also give you an idea of how much they wanted to push the concept of peace to black people. And I realized this, you know, it didn't occur to me as a child, obviously, but I realize now. They kept pushing this peace concept to us, this peaceful concept to us, because they were still fearful from the riots that were happening in the 1960s, the race riots happening in the 1960s. So therefore, they keep pushing peace, 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 and they don't want, you know, very funny thing happened when I was in fourth grade. In fourth grade, we had to write little essays about freedom fighters. And they were expecting us to write about people like George Washington, Paul Revere. I wrote about Nat Turner because I saw Nat Turner as a freedom fighter. My teacher was beside herself. How could I consider him a freedom fighter? And my question at the tender age of 9 was, how is what he did different than what George Washington did?
Okay, hold that thought. We're talking about the protests against police brutality and racial injustice this hour. Do these protests feel different than previous civil rights protests? Is this the start of meaningful change, or have we been here before? You can join the conversation, 866-999-4626, or send us an email, thepoint@capeandislands.org. More after break. You're listening to The Point. We're discussing the protests against police brutality and racial injustice this hour. With us is Dolores Deluz, a civil rights activist, founding member of the Zion Union Heritage Museum, and founding member and past officer of the Cape Cod NAACP. Also with us is Morgan James Peters, or Moalim, as he's more commonly known, a performer, writer, and associate professor of English and Black Studies at UMass Dartmouth. Also joining us now is another youth activist, Diamond Arujo, who she's the founder of Young Activists for Social Justice for Martha's Vineyard. She organized the Sunday, June 14th March against systemic racism and police brutality. Welcome, Diamond.
Hello.
Hi. Diamond, what prompted the formation of Young Activists for Social Justice, and what's been the response of your peers?
I would say, I mean, the social media has been covering protests and these riots happening across the world. And honestly, Grayson's protest that she organized was just such a great look for our community. Like, I just couldn't believe the people who came out, all the walks of life, you know, just coming to support this. And this topic of racism and systematic oppression and the bias against people of color, it's just been ignored and swept under the rug for too long. And we kind of made this group to bring it to the forefront here. So
What kinds of change would you like to see in your community on the Vineyard, or within the country as a whole?
I mean, I just want to see people, you know, listening and learning and playing their part, playing their role, educating themselves, donating to causes, fighting for this racism and this inequality, supporting Black businesses, speaking up against family and friends, having those tough questions and conversations, and just not letting this die off, you know, keeping this momentum going and making some real change here.
So what are your plans to keep the momentum going?
I've been talking to the Associate Commissioner for the Youth for Dukes County. They advocate for the social and physical health for children island-wide. We have one of our activists, Danielle Hopkins, attended the last Oak Bluffs Town Hall meeting, asked some tough questions about, you know, police budgets and what the defunding would look like if that was an option. And just kind of starting these conversations and, planning and assisting in, you know, these events. We're talking about doing a vigil with the Grace Preschool. And a big thing, I think, is voting. So we're going to be helping youth registering to vote, educating themselves on who they're voting for, even offering rides to the polls, you know, helping people get there. So just, you know, little things in little areas to make a big change.
All right. Diamond Arujo, founder of Young Activists for Social Justice for Martha's Vineyard. Diamond, thanks for joining us. And again, keep us posted on your efforts going forward. We'd love to hear from you.
Will do. Thank you for having
Thank you.
Me. I really appreciate
you
it.
You bet. Dolores, I wonder your thoughts on, you know, hearing these young people, young activists, and, you know, they're so hopeful and optimistic. What are your thoughts?
I am so glad that they're here and doing what they're doing because, frankly, I'm tired. I don't have the energy to be out and marching, and I'd rather be in my garden. I've, like, done this before, and I just want to see it happen. I think it's going to happen because there are so many different people involved. We have many, many more white people involved, young people involved, of all sorts, mixed race, LBGQ, just everybody. So I think it's not just a black problem to me anymore. It's a human problem just to treat people decently. Right. As my husband would say, just do the right thing. You know, it's not that hard to be decent to people and to know that one group of people want the same thing as other people. I mean, that's our right. That's our given right to be able to live in a community peacefully and harmoniously with others. So I think this might work. What can I say? I hope it does.
You've been working for it for decades. Mawalimad, I'd like to ask you the same thing. Looking at, you know, when I am having conversations with people of color, they're pointing out a really important thing is people of color can't do this alone. This has to be white people. It takes white people to make this change, right?
Here's the bottom line. The United States itself was formed on white supremacy. That was a foundation principle. When you look at it, we're the first country to actually have racial categorization as legal definition, and those legal definitions determining people's rights, abilities, etc., coming from the Commonwealth of Virginia. Excuse me. And then later being adopted as part of the federal law. When you consider that you have amendments and bills that can be put forward and taken away, and that even though we have protest and we have the vision of progression, when your foundation is white supremacy, that's not relinquished and it's never going to be relinquished, we're never going to actually have full progress because we're rooted in white supremacy.
Jeremiah is giving us a call from Chilmark. Good morning, Jeremiah. Thank you for holding.
Good morning. Yeah, I vote Dolores. And I'm sorry, it's the gentleman who just spoke again, his name?
Waleem.
Thank you both, Mo Wally. I'm calling in support. I'm Grayson's dad. I just calling in to say, you know, how incredible I think this is, the youth carrying this piece in the time that, you know, social media and media in general is kind of always bombarding you. It's hard to stay on point and stay on message. And I think that the voice just has to keep growing loud and growing strong. You know, great Grayson, as she said early on, started out in New Hampshire. When I grew up there, there was two black kids that I went to school with. That's how diverse, you know, we were there. And I don't know, it's not something that we always taught her, raising her, that no one's any better than anybody else. And like Dolores said, you know, just be kind, be real, be human, lead with your heart. And just culturally for her, it's something that she's connected to before this. She was working right now on an art installation piece where she's been painting on records, just different black leaders and community members throughout history that she's just something that's spoke to her and she's connected with. And when this happened, you know, I was really proud to see her take this action and this voice. So I just wanted to call in and say thank you. I wanted to say that, you know, I believe that we can have faith and that hopefully the youth will help us see a little more clearly and change. And I guess I wanted to ask Dolores again as well, just things that we could do to be moving forward, right? And and I wanted to plug for her because she didn't, that there is going to be a march tomorrow as well that she's put together that starts at Veterans Park at 1:30. There's a pretty long walk from there to Ocean Park in Oak Bluffs, and there'll be speakers there as well.
Okay, great, Jeremiah. Thank you. Thanks for calling. And Dolores, so Jeremiah is asking, you know, what can we do?
Well, I think you're doing a lot right now by just keeping it going and keeping it in the forefront. And the young people, they're the ones that's going to make the difference. And I have a lot of hope and prayers for them because they are the future. And they're the ones that are going to have to carry on when I'm gone and when you're gone. So I give it to the young people to take care, and I think they will because they, for one thing, they're mixed, they're married, intermarrying, and they've got black kids, the grandkids that got black husbands and wives, and you know, so we're all in this together. It's not just, like I said before, it's not a race thing. It's a human. When you get right down to it, it's a human thing, people.
Human thing.
It's not that hard. Just be good to each other. I don't have to love me, but at least respect me. Give me my...
Be kind, yeah. Just be kind, yeah. Paula writes, being of an age to remember the Civil Rights Movement, I can recall being less than in the eyes of America as a person with brown skin. I also recall the progress made in the years to follow, the recognition by white America of the wrongness of segregation, discrimination, and acts of violence against people of color. Even while people continued to hold racist views, and in a subversive way, racism remained largely systemic, it was at least unpopular to be a racist. We even elected an African-American president, a huge turning point, I believed. It was one I thought we would build on, not reverse entirely. What I see in the underbelly of America now is a return to pre-civil rights movement acceptance of racist beliefs and practices, and yes, it is, has even reached Cape Cod, where I experienced threats from a flag-waving, angry white man circling Mashpee Rotary as I protested the murder of George Floyd. Paula, thank you for sharing. We just have a couple of minutes left. Mawalimi, I wanted to ask you, what do you think what would meaningful change look like? What would that be?
Meaningful change? Well, a quick answer would be that my 17-year-old would not be experiencing the same things that I did at his age, which unfortunately he does. And when I say that, I mean even in terms of school expectation, perspective, point of view, directed towards him. What I believe brings about the positive change, however, is understanding that's the system. We have to, unfortunately, raise our children with that in mind. As black parents, we have to have that extra conversation with our children about society, the system, and how it's to be navigated. So that's where the change actually comes about, really, in the way that we prepare our young people for what's happening.
Mm-hmm. And are you hopeful?
I'm hopeful. Yeah, I have to be. Mm-hmm. Like, as I said, I'm a parent. I'm raising a child who I want to, you know, raise to a man, raise to a fully functioning man who can, you know, reach his full potential and do what he wants to do. So, yes, I am hopeful, definitely hopeful. Mm-hmm. Just recognize that what needs to be done to sustain it is beyond marching. What needs to be done to sustain it is beyond pumping our fists. That's stuff we do to feel better. Mm-hmm. What do we do? Yeah. As John Reed said earlier, what do we do after the march?
Right.
That's what will make me hopeful, is that if we actually institute some kind of change in policy, in structure, in interaction, in normalization, that's where the true change is going to come.
All right. Mawalim Morgan James Peters, thank you so much for being with us this morning. And Dolores Louise, thank you, Dolores, for all the work that you have done. And I hope you get plenty of time in your garden to relax. Thank you for being with us. And tune in, as we said, next week. We're going to talk about how white people can educate themselves and steps forward. We plan to do a number of these programs, and we hope you will join us. I'm Mindy Todd. Thank you for listening.
The Point is produced by Amy Vince. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Production assistance from Jenny Junker and Dan Tridle. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter.